And now it is time for the futures.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. Now, this segment will get pretty wild, so let's start relatively staid by telling you our guest's Wikipedia page. Okay. It says Sandy Stone artist. Roseanne Sandy Stone is an American academic theorist, media theorist, author, and performance artist. She is currently associate professor and founding director of the Advanced Communication Technologies Laboratory, the ACT Lab, and the New Media Initiative in the Department of Radio, TV, Film at the University of Texas at Austin. Okay, let's start with that.
Well, let's go from there. Okay. In about 1998, Sandy died and had already created an artificial intelligence in her image.
Really? And that's who we're talking to now?
That's who you're talking to. That's why, instead of a person in the studio, you're looking at that little black box with the blinky lights.
Well, it sounds good to me. Now, where does this
You could have had me fooled.
Yeah? See, well, you look so real. This is like Greg was talking to us about this new technology that hopefully we can project ourselves in the virtual space.
Isn't latex fantastic? It gets better all the time. If you put it on in very thin layers, it's translucent, so you get scattering effects, subsurface scattering.
And I can see the inside. Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so
you're here in Santa Cruz, not in Austin. Okay,
I'm
tell
here
us about that.
I moved to Austin through a series of accidents. I was originally studying with Donna Haraway up at the university in a program called History of Consciousness.
And Donna, here at the university?
At the university, right here in town. Uh-huh. And one day Donna said to me, they're starting a new science studies program down in San Diego, and you should go down and check it out and tell them about History of Consciousness, which was a very wild program.
Uh-huh. And so you went into that?
Well, she said, call them up. So I called them from her office. Mm-hmm. I got the head of the program. I told him who I was, and he said, what department are you in? And Donna waved at me. She said, don't say History of Consciousness. So I said, what department are you in? And he said, oh, sociology. Oh. And I said, oh, that's funny. I'm in sociology, too. So he said, oh, wonderful. Let's invite you down. So the next thing I knew, I was in San Diego.
Oh.
And that lasted for about 3 months. And I got kicked out of the program.
Why, what'd you do?
Because I said something in Santa Cruzese.
Well, like consciousness?
Well, I'll repeat it for you. I'm sorry about this, folks. This is pretty theoretical. I said, we will hold these discourses in productive tension rather than allowing them to collapse into univocal accounts. And that was enough to get me shot through the heart.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
That's sort of like saying we can agree to disagree, or what is it?
That was pretty much what it was. It was a simple postmodern statement. What it meant was, we can't be sure that this is true, but who controls the meaning of how we make these facts? Mm. So let's think about the meaning. And we'll do that by getting a number of viewpoints here. And they're not equal, but let's think about how they fight with each other, how they pull and tug against each other to create some other reality.
Very interesting.
That was enough to get me thrown out because it was too Santa Cruz-y.
In the 90s, they weren't really looking for diversity as much as they were looking for agreement.
No, and I understand that now. Yeah, I mean, yes.
So then the Texans came in on this? And
then the Texans came in. I got headhunted to Austin.
And they related more to your sensibilities over there?
Well, they related to something, probably my craziness. And they brought me out there, quote unquote, to drag the radio, television, and film department kicking and screaming into the 20th century.
Oh, well, where were they at when you get there?
They were in, I think, the 17th.
Media? I mean, it's like Ben Franklin.
I got them as far as the 19th. I was there for 20 years.
And telegraphs?
I think taking
telephone,
them
maybe?
Beyond that would have required the power of gods. But
in plurality.
All right. At least you retired the key and the kite.
Right? So they were really all good people.
Yeah, they let you set up your own program there?
They let me set up my own program. It was called the ACT Lab, which stood for Advanced Communication Technologies
Laboratory.
Is that
like the MIT Media Lab? Or?
It was more like what we would now call new media.
New media.
It was anything you could think of to do as long as it involved making something.
Making something out of media in this
now
case.
Now we call them makerspaces. Mm-hmm. I allowed anything.
So you were not just into media, you were into like robots too, right?
Right. You could make a robot if you wanted to, and several people did. Hmm. But you had to also explain it in some kind of theoretical term, which was the intersection between what I was doing and the department. But we can forget that part.
Okay.
It didn't matter. One person built a hugging machine.
Really?
With the hydraulics and pneumatics. It was this huge device built, remember there's a theoretical component. It's built on Temple Grandin's idea. Do you know who Temple Grandin
is? Oh, sure, yes. Yeah, she worked to create more compassionate animal machines to, for instance, bring cows to slaughter, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I'm sure many other claims to fame along those lines.
She's been very effective, very influential. And one of the things that she herself says is she's on the spectrum. Her particular form, which she refers
autism,
to as autism,
yeah.
requires, she discovered one way to deal with it, is to be hugged.
She invented the hug box.
She built the hug box, and she gets in it, apparently every day, and lets it hug her. And one of my students, and by the way, this student was not even in the class. He was in the University of Texas Building and Grounds Department. He was this big, muscled guy, not a student, not faculty, staff. And he was so fascinated by what we were doing that he came over and took the class.
Really? Wow.
And then he built an enormous hug bot.
So besides her hug box, he built a hug box in your program.
Well, his hug box was a variation on hers. It had a loud speaker on top. And as it hugged you with loud hissing, clanking, robotic noises, the loud speaker said, love you.
Was sounds scary.
Was he on the autistic spectrum too?
He was willing to go there. That was the important thing. You had to be willing to go there.
Yeah, you had to be willing to explore that. That's funny. Well, okay, so we're up to Texas. Actually, I knew you before Texas as well. We'll get into that after the break. I guess we were in an article in Vanity Fair together with a few other friends.
Oh, that was a wonderful article. We'll be back after the break. We'll tell you all about it.
Yeah.
Great. All
this
right.
This is the Dr. Future Show with Sandy Stone in studio. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're in the studio with Sandy Stone, our local Renaissance artist, scientist, whatever you want to label you want to put on her. You're welcome to it, but it's probably not going to work for this whole conversation. So, Sandy, so you were teaching students in Austin, and there's a lot of young students into media. They're no doubt very interested in relationships, sexuality, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, and they have a lot of energy, right? So did any of them ever want to use media for, like, having sex in cyberspace?
Every one of them did.
Really?
I don't think there was one that didn't.
Did they ever propose a project that you approved?
I approved them all the time. Well, let's start with the good stuff.
Okay.
a woman named Honoria Starbuck, who is still a dear friend of mine, made a project called Honoria in Cyberspazio, which was an Italian opera in the grand style, set in cyberspace and actually performed in cyberspace. It was the first opera that was actually
full-blown, high-quality audio opera.
Which included sex between a character in the opera called Honoria and a cyborg, was a kind of an android, a humanoid character of somewhat indeterminate gender. And that was a good time. And from there, it was all either uphill or downhill, depending upon whether you were standing on your head. And so we were off into robot land.
Well, what about two real people being able to connect over a distance?
I should mention that my husband and I met online. So we came in with the idea that that was possible because we'd beaten the odds and done it. It's a lot more common now, but at that time, the odds of your meeting anyone who was compatible online were nil. Really? It was practically impossible. And here were these two geeks online at opposite ends of the West Coast.
What was your initial connection with him? Was it a text? Or?
It was text. We met and courted through text, and then we lived together online in a virtual environment, what was called a MU, which meant multiple user environment, and object-oriented for you tech-minded people out there. And we lived in it for a year.
Really? While you were physically in different locations?
While we were physically in different locations.
Wow.
It was wonderful. I can attest to that. I don't just talk about these things in theoretical terms. Well, let me go back a little further than that. Let's go back to the 1980s.
Yes, that's when I first knew you.
I was living up in the woods at that point in Scotts Valley on a collective farm, if you will, a collective farm of witches. And we were having a very good time.
Pagan witches?
Neo-paganism, yes.
Worshipping nature.
Worshipping nature and sunlight and fresh air and organic food.
Sort of popular thing at the time in Santa Cruz,
And it was a lovely place to do it at that point. And I looked out my window one day and there was a cloud of dust on the road and it resolved itself into a motorcycle. And there was a young person on it dressed all in black leather. And the closer it got, the more indeterminate its gender became. And eventually, she identified as woman identified and said, I have places to take you and things to show you. I barely had time to say, science fiction, when we were off. I was on the back of her bike, and we rode up to Berkeley. And in Berkeley, there was an old Victorian house. And the house was filled with people who did phone sex. And it was the old days before cell phones, before the internet. So they had rows of 800 number telephones. And they would go off and they'd pick them up and have a client on the other end. And they'd take billing by credit cards.
Yes, yeah, like, 900 number thing too. I remember
later on, the 900 number thing developed. This was right before that, so they had to
800s.
They had to do 800s.
So she took you there, and what happened?
Well, I watched for a while first, and I realized that these people were doing data compression. They didn't have the advantages of physical appearance or touch or smell. All they had was voice, very narrow channel communication, like I'm doing now with you folks out there. And they had to recreate with nothing but their voices, their smell, their fragrance, what their bodies looked like, the way they moved.
Right.
And they did that by kind of compressing it down into a little token of speech, and then they would ship it down through the wire. And the person on the other end of the phone would take that token and sort of put it in boiling water and let it expand into a fully formed human being that they could look at.
Yeah, real fantasy reality thing.
And I thought, wow, I'm doing media here and academics. And then I got on the phones. I mean, after a while, they said, would you like to take a client? And I thought, yeah, let's do this.
Really? On the first time you were visiting?
Uh-huh. Oh, so it turned into what in the academic world of anthropology we call participant observation. So all the time I'm doing this, I'm taking notes for anthropology.
So did you?
Eventually I'll write a paper about it.
Yeah. Did it go well that first time?
It went very well. I discovered that I was good on the phone. Hmm. And
you kept the person on the line for a while?
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about it was looking at the other people who were doing this. There was a mother suckling her child. There was a woman in pajamas with her feet up on the table. You know, everybody very laid back. She had a drink in one hand, and at the same time, she had a headphone on, and she was giving sex to some guy in Paducah.
All verbally. Just a lot of trip.
So they were living their lives in the room of ease. Living lives of ease, and over the phone, they were these exotic people. And I thought, wow, this is interesting.
Yeah.
How can we theorize this?
Or how can you play with it in new and interesting ways? Did you bring some of that back to the university here?
Oh, very much. Oh, yeah. First, I brought it back to Scotts Valley.
Oh, to your community.
Where it didn't have a lot to do, but then I brought it to Texas when I went there. And there's a lot of phone sex in Texas because it's Texas. And everything's bigger there. The phone sex is bigger. The phones are bigger. Everything.
Wow.
And we did that. And I took, first of all, in the classroom, I had the issues to deal with that I was transgender and it was Texas. In Texas at that time, it was so not okay to be transgender. There was a bus that did tours of the campus for fundamentalist universities in other parts of the state, fundamentalist universities and colleges of various denominations. And I heard from a member of my department that when they went by our building, and the bus driver said, "This is the communications building," someone on the bus said, "That's where Sandy Stone works. She teaches young children to change their sex." And I thought, oh, boy. And this is Texas, you know, where you could be a little afraid to go out at night.
Yeah, that's pretty strong words. change your sex. Huh?
Change your sex, which was not what I did. Actually,
no, I would imagine that people who were maybe thinking about their gender would maybe consult you to see, well, because you're a pioneer in that arena, to see what you had to say about it. I would think that probably happened more often than
eventually.
Than not, right?
Eventually, it did. But the interesting people were from Austin. Is a strange place. It doesn't really belong in Texas. You could pick it up and put it down in California, and it would be fine. Austin is 50% Berkeley. The other 50% is Bakersfield. So it's a very interesting place.
Berkeley plus Bakersfield, as opposed to Berkeley plus San Francisco, which gave us our 60s revolution over here.
Yes. Not so lucky there, but at least you can be glad you've got the Berkeley part.
Yeah.
Because the politicians there, the members of the legislature who do all that horrible stuff about abortion and freedom of speech and voting rights and all that, have to live somewhere. So they want to live in a place that is pretty good.
Yeah, so as long as you didn't leave Austin, you were okay.
You were fine. Yeah. As soon as you got outside of Austin, you knew you were in Texas.
So you changed your dress and stuff like that. Did the university itself give you the freedom to do what you wanted to there?
They did. My department didn't, but the university did. That was very interesting. Not too many people know I didn't get tenure. My department kicked me out, but the university reversed it, which meant that I had tenure and promotion and all the perks that go with the academic life in a department that didn't want me there, which makes it a lot of fun to be there if you know how to do the dance and play the game.
And you were there for like 20 years, right?
20 years.
Yeah.
In the heart of the beast, the very belly of a very interesting situation. And I did well, and I had fun. I don't recommend it unless you have a very strong stomach. Yeah. But I did have fun. My students had fun. We had a very good time.
Did you feel like you're on a mission being there?
I was on a mission from God. I just couldn't figure out which God. But that was okay because nobody else could either. And they all knew which God they were on the side of, but nobody could figure out which one. Was I representing Marduk? Was I representing Inanna? Who was I really there for? But In the ACT Lab, you could do that. In the ACT Lab, I had one of my students did a Jesus project that, you know, we all know Jesus is all around us, he said. So he built a machine that extracted the Jesus from the air. It had a fan that blew the air through it, and this thing extracted the Jesus component of the air, and it stored it up in a little tank. And then later, you could stand in front of it and push a button, and it would reverse the fan, and it would blow the Jesus over you, so you got specially blessed.
Have a whiff of Jesus.
And I might remind you also that radio is, if you think back to the origins of radio, radio started back at a time when Thomas Edison thought that he was inventing the phonograph because it was a way to communicate with the dead.
Oh, wow.
Communicate with the dead.
Well, I guess we turned that one around a little bit. Maybe we have an audience we don't even talk to who doesn't call in. I don't know.
I'd like to ask all the dead people
we'll be back
who are
after
listening
the break.
To call in.
Yeah, all the dead people, please call now. We have a special number for you. Oh, dear. Okay, well, this is the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Sandy Stone, and we'll be right back after...
just a couple of commercial breaks.
All right.
Okay.
Talk to you soon. Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Sandy Stone. When she was, now we were talking about some of your ACT Lab experiments. During the break, you were talking about EVP, electronic voice communication with the other side, the dead. Mm-hmm. And the students, you said, came up with some ideas to test that out?
They came up with a number of ideas that were spectacularly good. Radiv voices are a phenomenon discovered by Constantine Radiv in the 19th century, which was...
When we first had recordings, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. He found that if you put a tape recorder in a silent room, left it there for a while, that you could analyze the silent tape later and recover voices from it. He felt that those were voices of the dead trying to communicate with us, and because the dead don't have vocal cords, they don't have lungs, they can't make sounds that are very loud. So
yeah, that was very popular in Art Bell. Remember that in the 90s?
That was the origin of spirit trumpets in the 18th and 19th century that were popular in seances. It was the same thing, amplifying them.
So what did you think? Did you do any of those experiments?
We did a lot of them, and they're fascinating. The secret is in the filtering. It's in what you do to them, but you can recover people. Later, I have some samples that you might be interested in hearing.
Yeah, I'll put that on the podcast version.
Okay, that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
People saying, I love you.
Coming through?
Coming through, yeah.
Did they seem to interact with questions?
They can't do that because you have to process the
So it's
tapes.
Not real time, then?
It's not real time. It would be interesting to build a box that did it in real time, but you need absolute silence. And it's very hard to get that when you have other people in the room. But you might be able to do it by being in the next room and shouting the questions and seeing what happens.
See if you get kind of... So what do you think? Do you think there are... that they hear us on the other side? Or what's your narrative about communications from the other side at this point?
Well, I think they hear us, but they haven't quite decided whether they like what we say.
Yeah. Would they be us, though? Only dead?
Only dead, yeah. Yes. I know. I have an extremely large dead audience.
Yeah, I see.
And they call in, but they do it silently, so I can't hear them.
Sorry,
I have to process
the signal.
Tapes to find out. It takes days to do a phone call. It's really awful.
Yeah, I mean, you think Mars is hard?
Mars is nothing compared to talking to dead people.
I know. If you look at it purely objectively, if we had good communications with the dead, then it would change everything. The whole paradigm of life itself would probably not be what it is today.
Well, we're working on ways of making the dead visible. It turns out you use infrared light, and you can see them, which... I'll explain later.
Yeah. Do they look green?
Did they wave?
They've both arms out in front. They've all adopted the classic zombie pose. It's very popular.
There must be a reason for it. Oh, the mysteries of death.
Spiritual rigor mortis.
But we were talking about robot sex.
Yes, that's right. And now that's bring a little life to this conversation.
Yeah, let's get back to normal here.
Yeah, robot sex. Now, that was something I'm sure more than one student proposed as well.
They did, and a number of people did it, and with varying degrees of success, because there were a lot of things that they had to figure out about robots before you could do robot sex. I mean, there's very simple ways that you can do robot sex. There's just simple physical gratification. But sex is more than just simple gratification. It has a spiritual dimension, a metaphysical dimension, philosophical.
But with robots, though, how deep can you go?
10 yards? 15?
Do people fall in love with robots?
People do fall in love with robots. A Japanese person, whose name escapes me at the moment, married his robot, and he says she's a very good conversationalist and takes good care of him. And we can, at this point, at this fork in the road, as the dimness closes in on us here, we can choose a fork in which we actually talk about the more weird parts of robot sex, or we can go over here and talk about how you imbue objects with agency, which is a little bit more serious. So I'm going to let you pick. Which way we go? Do we go the serious route, or do we go the weird, crazy, I don't know what's happening now route?
Well, let's keep Santa Cruz weird.
Okay, so if you go the robot sex route, that takes you down some very interesting corridors. People are kinkier than we imagine them, and like the world being strange, they are kinkier than we can possibly imagine. So
you know, you're always amazed yourself, and you've seen some pretty far-reached boundaries, and still, it's weird.
Fortunately, the human race never fails to surprise me.
Yeah.
I was going to say, never succeeds in failing to surprise me, but that might not mean anything to you out there.
Yeah, but then nature takes it even further.
There are things, slime molds having sex is a very interesting thing to watch. Bees, snakes, aardvarks, everybody has sex in their own way. You probably know the duck penis thing. Ducks have co-evolved, males and females. Ducks conduct sex by rape, which is at this point not a very nice thing for humans to talk about.
I mean, they just jump them? I mean,
The males jump the females, and so the females have evolved corkscrew vaginas in order to keep the males' penises out. And the males, in turn, have evolved corkscrew penises
in order to be able to compensate.
And this is in co-evolution right now, and the females have incredibly complicated vaginas, and the males keep trying to catch up as hard as they can, and clearly they do.
But it's been established that the female leads the evolutionary spiral.
Yes, definitely. But there are always ducklings, so we know eventually the males get through, but it's not easy for them.
So really, selection is based on who can figure it out.
Mm-hmm. And eventually,
intelligence here.
Yeah, but they're going to reach a point of no return. Eventually, the female duck's vagina will have to be so long that it will take up all the available space, and then they will be in an ecological dead end. But fortunately, they're not there. It's likely to go on
a few more billion years before that happens.
Which leads us to the shapes of female, feminine robot vaginas. We should talk first about what it means to say female.
Yeah, I mean, robots, we do choose often female voices for our AIs now, like the Siri and Alexa.
Yeah.
Though, you know, I use Echo on one of mine. I kind of like that a little better. Not too many people are named Echo.
And this is about power balance, which is what a magazine recently wanted me to send them an article about, which I'm still working on. As we all know, folks, particularly AM people, the genders are not equal opportunity genders. There's a gender imbalance. There are power imbalances in gender relationships. And thanks to the Me Too movement, we find out more and more about that every day. And that extends into, we think, when we start thinking about robots. what kind of robots are we going to build? What kind of ethics are those robots going to have? And in particular, how are robots going to treat humans with regard to sex? Are we going to preserve the power imbalances in our robots?
Well, initially, we'd probably replicate just what we know because we don't know any better.
Right.
Right? And the machines actually have no limits as we understand them to be. And if they ever develop any sense of sentience, then they'll have to figure it out for themselves.
And they are not figuring it out very well yet. But
and they don't even need sex as we know it, right? The replication, I guess, would be the thing. And
they can copy themselves, which is...
Right.
And
right.
Artificial intelligences are even better at that.
Yes, they can talk to thousands of people at once, too.
So here's the thing. When we're designing robots, what is the one defining characteristic of humans? And you get all these philosophical things going on. The characteristic of humans is that we reproduce. And we reproduce by the sex act.
And that's true for most of biology. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes, indeed. But it's not true for machines. And so when we talk about building a machine that can think like a human, if the machine doesn't have sex, then...
How could it be like a human?
Be
because
like
humans
human.
Are so into sex.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I work with a lot of sex therapists in a professional capacity. And in talking to them, one of the things I find is that dealing with the large human population, 99% of the human population, sex is the thing on everybody's mind all the time. And that's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It just defines us as humans. Mm-hmm. And artificial intelligences, even the best ones that we deal with, do they ever talk about the reproductive act? No.
No, you'd have to imbue into them some kind of fundamental biological urge to even begin to contemplate that.
Yeah, which is a good trick. How do we do that?
And make them part biology. Maybe put biology into a silicon substrate.
Well, that's the trick. The trick is, what does that even mean? How do we put biology into a silicon substrate? Because we really don't know what biology is. We talk a lot about it. And we talk around it. I call it the unnameable discourse, because what is life? Well, life is that it reproduces, right? Life is irritable. Life has to eat. You know, like the da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, we can define all those things that are what life is about, but it doesn't really tell us what life is. And the more we look at life, the more we find that essential thing escapes us. So when we get there, when we really know what we're talking about, then maybe we can make a robot that can do it. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, we have to simulate it in a similar way to the way that the sex workers on the telephone were simulating it. They were imagining sex acts for people on the other
end. Scenarios that they could relate to.
Scenarios. Faking physicality.
Oh, so we can get good at that.
Yeah, that's what we got to get good at, but we got to go away now for a while.
Yes, we'll be back after the break talking to Sandy Stone here in the studio. Welcome back to the show. We're talking with Sandy Stone. We were talking about sex and robots for a while, and I'm just wondering, have you thought much about religion and robots?
Well, only to the extent that I've been searching for Jewish robots.
Yeah. And
when I found my first
one... You find one?
I found several of them in a small colony in Lithuania where they were hiding out. And robots and religion are a very interesting thing. Some robots are highly religious things because they know more about God than we do. And we have a lot to learn from them
really?
In that regard. God, as it turns out, God is not, after all, a black lesbian saxophone player. God is much more complex.
And if anybody would know, it would be the robots. Can we have a caller, Mrs. Future?
Yes, we do. We have got Colonel Terry.
Colonel Terry, all right.
Hi, Colonel Terry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, smart lady, and your lucky husband.
How you doing, Colonel?
Fine, I hope you're well. And your guest and the program, you started out on consciousness and what is it, and then we've delved into the permutations of sexual attraction and function, and I'm not sure where we are now, but let me tell you what I know about consciousness.
Yeah.
and I'm curious of your guest's reaction. Madam, I have been declared dead twice. One in a very significant situation in a surgery where they really thought they'd sent me to the happy hunting ground. And later, the doctor and I discussed things, and I didn't tell the Air Force psychiatrist all of my experience for obvious reasons. But I'm quite convinced, 70%, that there is a continuity of consciousness. And I shared this years later, and some years ago, with Stephen Hawking when I encountered him at a reception. And I inquired, would he accept that possibly, if human consciousness has a continuity, that it may interact with one of the 7, 9, or 11 string theory dimensions that he posits. And he thought for a moment, leaned back, and then said through his computer-derived speaker, you know, Terry, that's possible. You should research it.
So here you go. Okay. So researching, going with Sandy, any thoughts on that?
And again, the mystery of consciousness, does my Scottish Terrier, Mr. MacGuffin, possess it as we do? I don't believe so. But what is your own view? And by the way, I'm totally a former ex-Catholic for reasons of having a high IQ and a capacity to reason from my perspective.
That's fine with me. I'm suspicious of all religions, regardless of... That's fine.
Let's jump to consciousness, please. Do you believe there'll be a continuity of human consciousness? And could the late Dr. Hawking be correct in which he says it is possible it engages one of the other dimensions?
Well, I think that you've put it in a much more interesting way than I ever could, because you talked to Stephen Hawking's computer, and it told you that...
That's true. That's true. Both of those things, actually.
I was actually...
Both of you. What's your own opinion, observation?
Oh, my God. You're asking me to get real, which means I have to find a real persona.
Yeah, what's your narrative on this one?
And I don't actually have a real persona handy, but let's take a shot at this. Consciousness is something that I had in a box in the ACT lab and that I could parcel out to the various robots that we had there. So I'm inclined to think that because when we're done with the robots, we can recapture it, put it back in the RAM, that we have a kind of continuity. In other words, I'm not exactly with the transhumanists who believe that you can upload consciousness, but as a person who's uploaded my consciousness, I feel that it's certainly possible. Because as the people in the studio with me, as Ellen and Son will tell you, there's nobody in the studio with them. There's just a recorder here with some fancy equipment connected to it. And if we can do that, then certainly consciousness can be continued through bodies and through hardware and through software and mysterious pieces of your unawareness. And then what happens is, after you do download your consciousness back into your body, you go down, while you're experiencing the comfort and the warmth of that, you find yourself slipping down the drain, and then you run through the pipes, and then you come up somewhere in Paducah, Kentucky, where you can watch the mating dance of the sandhill cranes, and you look to the right, and there's a man in a dark suit there, and you look to the left, and there's a man in a dark suit, and he says, I'm Bob, and the guy on the other side says, I'm Bob, and you realize you're Bob too, and you're all Bob, and it's wonderful. So I hope that answers your question adequately.
It does not.
Well, I would
what is your own view?
I'd say what it turns to me is that perhaps part of us is non-local.
Part of us is non-local. Non-locality is the secret of everything. I can manipulate my brain out in a solar system on Rigel, and it will affect my brain right here because we're both entangled.
That's a big enough universe for that to perhaps actually happen.
Absolutely. They entangled me and then they took me away and I couldn't get unentangled.
So easy travel to other planets would probably not be in metal ships.
Not
but through consciousness itself.
Through biological ships. We were talking about biology and we travel by focusing the biological antenna on the distant star field and then our consciousness is launched out of the end of that biological floppy antenna.
Yeah, that ties with Bruce Lipton's idea that there are protein antennas on every cell.
Absolutely. And they're broadcasting all the time, and we are coming out of the little molecules in your body right now.
Colonel Terry, if you could turn down your radio, I keep having to pot your volume down because it's got an echo on it.
Oh, that was up. Right.
I thought you were doing that deliberately.
No, that's a form of communication. I just want to hear you better. Okay.
Anyway, well,
much better. Thanks.
So I am curious as to what you are planning to do here in Santa Cruz now in our last few minutes. What's next for you, Sandy?
I'm going to settle down and raise hell as usual.
Yeah.
I've built a small recording studio. Actually, I've built a large recording studio, fully analog, where I'm having fun at the moment.
When I first met you, I think you had a store downtown Santa Cruz, a stereo store?
Wizard of Odd.
Yeah.
I can talk about it because we're not there anymore, so it's not a commercial plug.
Yeah.
There was a story behind getting there, but I won't bother you with it. Mm-hmm. But we had a lot of fun at the Wizard of Odd because downtown on the mall, everyone would drop by.
Mm, that's
wonderful,
right. Nice location.
Weird
socially.
People. Mm-hmm. And we had a great time. We would serve tea. We had a couch. It was a very strange store with couch and tea.
Mm. And you yourself are an audio mixer, producer, director. You love audio.
I love audio. I have a recording studio. I do work with musicians who can play and are interested in working with me. My original history was with Jimi Hendrix back in the old days. And the fact that I'm here now indicates that I stopped working with some of my early clients because a lot of my early clients are dead now at early ages, and I'm delighted to still be here talking with both of you on this show.
Yeah.
So clearly I survived those days of acid rock and battery acid.
You mixed Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah, I didn't know you didn't know that.
No, I didn't know.
I did a lot of his early work, and Van Morrison, and Crosby, and Nash.
The plant? You were at the plant in Sausalito?
I was at the plant in Sausalito, but only by visit.
That's one of the epic recording studios of all time.
Yeah, but I was based at Record Plant New York. And then we built the chain out. So I went to Sausalito, I went to L.A., but I didn't originate there. I originated at the original Record Plant in New York.
Wow.
And Record Plant was originally going to be a franchise. We were going to open places in Chicago and Memphis and Nashville. We didn't get to do all of them, but we got a certain number of them going.
Oh,
and I moved around to some of them.
Now back in Santa Cruz for doing some more audio explorations.
And having fun with you on the air.
You're playing the radio.
And building robots that can do sex and have consciousness and find religion.
Here in Santa Cruz?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we're cooking with gas now, folks. Well, I'm glad you're in the neighborhood, Sandy.
Good to be out.
We were both in the
good to be back.
Yeah, we're both in the same article, "Wired to God" by Frank Rose.
That was a lovely article. We should talk about that.
Yeah, 1980. We'll bring you back on real soon. All right, thanks again for being on the show.
Bye, folks.
And we'll be speaking soon. That's another week on the Dutch Future Show. Ms. Future, thanks you for mixing it all up. And Sandy, thank you for being here. Very cool. Well, I didn't know you were part of Mondo 2000 either. A lot to talk about here. All right, goodness. All right.
I've been everywhere, man.
This is KSCO Santa Cruz, everybody. Thanks for listening to Dr. Future Show. Another week. We'll see you next Future Tuesday.